Okay, good evening. Our topic for tonight is the second term of office of Menachem Begin. So we're going to discuss tonight 1981 through 83 and maybe a little bit of the term of Yitzhak Shamir, 83 into 84. So when Begin was reelected, he formed a very narrow coalition of 48 seats from the Likud party and 13 seats total from the religious parties of the National Religious, Aguda, and Tami, the Abuchatzera's newfangled Sephardic party. And although it was a much smaller coalition than the first go-around, which Begin at one point in time had in the high 70s in his coalition, he actually had greater authority and ability to govern the second time than the first time. And the reason is because of greater ideological proximity of the parties involved. That the troika of Begin, Sharon, and Shamir, occupying the three most important positions in the cabinet, was much more homogeneous, let's say, than a cabinet filled with the likes of Moshe Dayan, Ezer Weitzman, and Yigal Yadin, all of whom harbored more dovish tendencies than Menachem Begin ever did. So they were supposed to be, at least in the late 70s, a moderating influence on the prime minister. Whether that ever happened is a debatable point. But after 1981, there was no moderating influence. Everybody else who was at the top was just as hard-line, hard-nosed as the prime minister himself. Later on, the government would become even more to the, further to go even further to the right with the addition of Tichiyah, which was a breakaway that opposed the withdrawal from Sinai, opposed the Camp David Accords, and they held three seats, and they were very much against the withdrawal, but as soon as the withdrawal happened, they joined the government. Why? Because the Aveira was done, it was behind everybody, and now what does the far right want to do? Prevent another Aveira. What would the next Aveira be? A withdrawal from the West Bank. Okay, so you don't take part in the sin, but then you prevent the next sin. That was the viewpoint of Tichiyah, and also Telem joined the government at that point as well, after Dayan's death. So, in the early phases of this administration, the second Begin term, an important consideration was relations with the United States of America. The Labor Party had tried to depict itself as the party more aligned with the desires of the American administration, and therefore likely to cultivate better relations with the superpower, and that Likud should not be put into office because they're too hard-line and they're going to get into conflict with everyone around the world, including our great benefactor, the United States. And there's something to be said for that. There's an element of truth there. But, nonetheless, relations with the United States in the early 80s had their positive moments. There were ups and there were downs. Let's try to examine what the ups were and what the downs were. In the middle of 1981, just before the election, was the bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactor, which led to a condemnation by the United States of Israel in the UN, together with, of course, many other countries, and the delay of shipment of F-16s. So that's not a good thing from an Israeli point of view. Another thing that was happening simultaneously was America's tilt towards Saudi Arabia. And the sale of the AWACS and the fighter jets to the Saudis that Israel thought was going to change the balance of military power in the Middle East. That up until that point in time, the Arabs had Soviet weaponry that was far and away inferior to what Israel had, courtesy of the United States, and now a significant Arab country, Saudi Arabia, was going to be supplied with the most advanced American weaponry. And that scared people in Israel. So the big question was whether or not Israel's friends in the United States should throw their political weight around in trying to prevent this deal by lobbying Congress and the administration to nix the deal. Well, the Reagan administration was not going to turn its back on the Saudis. It was going to go forward. The real question was, could it pass in Congress? And Israel was in a lose-lose situation. Why is it a lose-lose situation? Because if the lobbying efforts are carried out and they're unsuccessful, then the bad guys have good weapons, have fancy weapons. And if the lobbying effort is successful, then what happens? Significant elements of the American public and the American defense industry are going to be angry that the Jews forced them to cancel contracts that were very lucrative. So it's and a dual loyalty issue also. Yeah, yeah, we can't ever ignore that. We can't not. So it was a tough situation. In the end, the major push against in Congress didn't really come to pass, and the Saudis got their weaponry. Okay. But then, relations with the U.S. took an even worse turn when the Begin administration very quickly put forth the Golan Heights legislation to annex the Golan Heights, to apply Israeli civil administration and civil law to an occupied territory. The United States was not given advance warning that this was going to happen in the Knesset, and they were very much offended by it. And so the State Department, together with the White House, canceled a prior agreement of understanding for strategic cooperation, which is a mouthful. But whatever it is, it means they're reneging on some sort of commitments, abstract commitments. So that's pretty bad. In 1982, things got even worse. As settlement construction continued in the West Bank, and increased exponentially, really, in Begin's second term, the Americans were not too happy. Bear in mind that Reagan had said settlements are not illegal, but they're unhelpful. So it's not as though the Reagan administration, even the pro-Israel wing of the administration, was looking favorably upon the settlements. They just weren't as nasty about it as Carter had been. Well, this is going to cause tension in the relationship, and that's further aggravated by Israel going to war in Lebanon, which was regarded as maybe an unnecessary war, and Israel's push to Beirut even further complicated things. Americans had to get involved in negotiating an Israeli and PLO withdrawal. It drew America into an area of conflict that it didn't really want to be in. So the massacre in Sabra and Shatila was the last straw. That was really the bottom, the lowest point in Israel-U.S. relations was in September of 1982. How did things improve? Well, they improved dramatically in 1983. The major event of 1983 was the death of 258 Marines, because Hezbollah caused trouble and blew up a barracks and killed a lot of Americans. And so for the first time, you had a situation where radical Islam or political Islam or just the Arab world isn't just killing Jews and Israelis, but rather they're killing American soldiers. And so that's going to turn the American government against the hostile elements in Lebanon and in closer cooperation with Israel. Also, the Soviets were mixing around at that time, and Israel, Shamir, who was newly installed as prime minister, tried to portray Israel as a bulwark against Soviet expansionism in the Middle East, and the Americans were receptive to that idea. So in late November of 1983, Shamir, together with Moshe Arens, the defense minister, showed up in Washington for a meeting at the White House with Reagan, and it was considered by Shamir the finest hour of Israel-American cooperation. Now, that's not to say that all the issues were resolved. They certainly weren't. The issue of the territories and the autonomy negotiations and Jewish settlement in the West Bank and Gaza, there was no consensus on that at all. The Americans didn't budge one inch. But those were papered over, and the bigger issues were the war in Lebanon, hostility in the Muslim world against the United States, and on that front, in the Cold War front, Israel was the good guy. So it also helped that Moshe Arens was an American who spoke a good English and had been the ambassador to the United States before his term as defense minister and had cultivated good relations with the pro-Israel wing of the Republican Party. So things were good in late 1983. Yeah.
Positive press from the investigation of the Shatila massacre, you know, an indication that Israel was willing to hang out the bet.
Right. The fact that it wasn't covered up, but rather it was brought to light by your own team, it shows a cheshbon hanefesh that other parts of the world would never do. And we'll get to that soon enough. Okay, so in the early phases of the second Begin term, what was the attitude of the government towards the territories and the autonomy negotiations? Well, it was a very hard line. And the public at large didn't mind that, because the public was moving further and further to the right. Public opinion polls from 1969 through 1983 show a consistent shift towards retention of the territories, and certainly not giving up large chunks of the territory. And people who were under the age of 30, who were voting in large numbers and voting for the Likud in large numbers, because after all, Labor had become an old person's party and Likud was the young people's party, the young people, they did not regard Judea and Samaria as Arab territory, but rather it was a place for the pioneering spirit and a place to do your army service. They were not old enough to remember when the West Bank really was Jordanian. Forget who should own it, but who did own it. In other words, if you came of age before 1967, then Ramallah was another country. It wasn't just a city with a bunch of Arabs, you know, 5 miles away. It was another country. So the young people don't see it that way, and therefore their attitude is, let's retain as much as we can. Ariel Sharon was of the viewpoint that Jordan is Palestine. And Sharon was never a big fan of King Hussein. Sharon, if he had his way, would have Yasser Arafat assassinate King Hussein, declare Jordan Palestine, for real, not just like in words, but explicitly, and then Israel holds on to the West Bank. And then you have a hostile border on the Jordan River, but Israel keeps all of its territory. In his mind, that would have been a favorable scenario. Yitzhak Shamir. Well, it depends. How do you define Palestinian? I mean,
they identify themselves as Palestinian.
I don't know. It's often said 50%, 60%, 70%, but I don't even know what that means, because if you're counting like refugees from the 48 war who went across the river and now live over there, that's one way of defining it. Self-identification, regardless of where your grandparents lived, is another way of defining it, but it's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. Greater Israel has been around since the days of revisionist Zionism. So as a practical matter, after the Six-Day War, even before the Six-Day War, there was a small fringe element of like Jewish terrorists who wanted to keep the Milchemet Ha'atzmaut going into the 1950s. And one of the chief rabbis, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, was a member of that terrorist group in his youth, but there was nothing from nothing. It was not until the Six-Day War that you have people realize, well, now we do control this territory. If we hold on to it, we can settle everywhere. Okay, so
why didn't he like Hussein?
Because Sharon's approach was, we want to hold on to the West Bank. We don't want any other Arab authority west of the river. But yet there is this Palestinian people, or this pretense of a Palestinian people, so let's have them get their political representation and their aspirations fulfilled in an existing Arab state, not on our plot of land. And as for King Hussein, he's just a phony king. Hashemite dynasty is invented by the British, so it could come and it could go. So Yitzhak Shamir, the foreign minister, was of the viewpoint that we are very flexible. But we've reached the limits of the concessions we're able to make. So let me explain what that means. It means that if you take into account the borders of Israel on June 11th, 1967, they're huge. Okay, the Six-Day War is over, and Israel is tremendous in size now. And about half of Israel was just lopped off in the giving away of the Sinai. So that's enough. You know, as for the other territories, we get to keep those. You know, we've given enough. That totally disregards and ignores the differences in reality, political reality, between a Sinai Peninsula on the one hand and a populated West Bank on the other. But Shamir was never bothered by those things. So we've done as much as we could do. Don't bother us anymore. Moshe Ahrens, who became the ambassador to the United States, said that Jews should be involved in the settlements in the West Bank as a matter of historic right and as a matter of security consideration.
Reagan was president at that point.
Reagan is president, yes. Now, Begin had an interesting view. He said the territories are disputed. And we have our claim and they have their claim. But it would be wrong to forbid Jews to settle in the West Bank while the disposition of the territories remain a bone of contention politically and diplomatically, because that creates a foregone conclusion that it becomes Arab territory. Rather, each side has to be able to make facts on the ground, and after all the facts are taken into account and they're all made, then we'll figure out who's in charge. So it's the exact opposite of what you heard in the 1990s out of the PLO, and for that matter out of the Clinton administration, that settlement building changes the facts on the ground when really it's an Arab territory and you want to Judaize it and tilt the demographics. And that's unfair. Begin's approach was, we don't know whose it is, but we want to do something and they want to do something. So we'll compete with each other simultaneously, and when it's all over, then we'll figure out whose it is.
Was there ever the concept that we'll build, and if we end up negotiating away, we're giving them a bone by giving them a set up and established.
No, in fact, the opposite is true. Okay, so the opposite. In Sinai, everything was destroyed. In the West Bank, the thinking was never to give a built up parcel of land to the enemy. If we build it, it's going to stay ours. Now, in Gaza in 2005, it was a little bit different. The synagogues, remember, were destroyed. But other things, industrial infrastructure was left standing until it was looted and disappeared. Yeah. Yeah.
Was Begin the prime minister a politician or an ideologue?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that question. In front of the public, he was an ideologue. However, in private, he was a politician. And the truth is, even in public, he was a politician, but not in the sense of moderating his rhetoric. But in private, there were many who sat in his cabinet meetings who would acknowledge that one day he would say, Yahareg v'al yavor, to do the following, and the next day it would happen. So he used a lot of highfalutin language, both Latin and Talmudic Hebrew, but he would sometimes backtrack just because the language was nothing but language. All right. So this is I've given you a flavor of what the leading politicians said about the territories. Now, one more point, that in late 1981, Sharon announced that we're going to try our best, Israel's going to try, to limit the IDF's involvement in the daily lives of the average Palestinian in the territories. That we want to have as light a footprint of the occupation as possible. They announced that, but the reality was otherwise. By 1982, the footprint of the occupation became much heavier. And the policy of openness to the Arabs of Eretz Yisrael, as it was called, really never came to pass.
Why do you use the word occupation?
Huh?
Why do you use the word occupation?
Well, when in dealing with the IDF's relationship with Arab residents of the West Bank, there's really no other word to use, because you could use administration, but that's a deceptive term. I would use the word administration if it was just a bureaucrat who sat on the sidelines and dictated certain aspects of the lives of the people who lived in the territories. But if they have to confront soldiers on a frequent basis, that's a military occupation. All right, yeah.
This is basically the same thing that Moshe Dayan said after the Six-Day War.
Right, he was hoping for a light-footed administration in the territories, and for a time there was, but by the 1980s, that proved to be impossible. Okay, so what about the autonomy talks? They were part of the Camp David agreement, and they were going nowhere. Begin and Sharon wanted to find local Arab notables who were willing to cooperate with Israel on these autonomy talks and who would remain independent from the PLO party line. But they had trouble finding such people. Now, why did they have trouble finding such people? Because you run the risk of getting killed if you buck the party line. The PLO is very powerful. Now, they're expelled. They're not in the West Bank. They're off somewhere else. They're in South Lebanon and later in Tunisia. But it's not an easy thing to be a non-PLO public figure in the West Bank or Gaza. So that basically failed. All right. In early 1982, Sharon and by extension Begin decided that it was time to go to war against the PLO in Lebanon, in South Lebanon. That too many terrorist attacks had happened in the northern part of Israel, including rocket fire across the border, and, just as importantly, attacks on Jews and Israelis abroad, in Europe especially. Of course, the straw that broke the camel's back was the attack on the ambassador in London, which made him paralyzed for life, and he died only a few years ago. But that was the last straw. But in January already, Sharon and Begin wanted to go to war. What prevented it from happening in the wintertime? Well, nobody goes to war in the winter. Number one, it's better to go to war in the summertime. It's more comfortable. But also, members of the government opposed going to war in a conflict that they regarded maybe as an optional war. So who was opposed? Yosef Berg, the leader of the NRP, who historically was a dove and closer to Labor than he was to Likud, and David Levy, the number two man in the Herut, the leading Sephardic figure in the government. He also said, we can't just go to war flippantly. There has to be good reason to go to war. People are going to die. But by June, the cabinet was ready to go to war. If this were a discussion of military history, we'd spend a whole few weeks on it, but we're going to just gloss over the military aspect. Politically, the agreement was Operation Peace for Galilee. We're going to clear out southern Lebanon of the Fatah fighters and whatever other hostile actors might exist in a 25-mile stretch, a 40-kilometer stretch, and then when we've been successful at doing that, we'll go home. And it won't last very long. We'll go in, we'll come out, done. After all, this had been done several times before. There was an operation in 1981. There was a major operation in 1978, Operation Litani. Okay, so it wasn't the first time that Israel would go to war against bad actors in Lebanon. The problem is that Sharon had ideas that he didn't share with everyone. And as the defense minister, he was in a position to conduct the war. And the prime minister was in no position to disagree with him because the prime minister, Menachem Begin, didn't know from military affairs and had to rely almost entirely upon the generals in his cabinet. Well, Sharon, let's say two things about him. One, Begin didn't fully trust him. He had to trust him in the conduct of the war, but at the personal level, he was very suspicious of Sharon. One, Sharon tried to challenge him for the Herut leadership in 1977. It was nipped in the bud, but he tried. And also, Begin said, Sharon is anti-democratic. If Sharon, as defense minister, thought he could get away with sending a battalion of troops and a bunch of tanks to surround the Knesset and have a coup, he would do it. Now, that's Lashon Hara, because it never happened. But he said it, that he thought Sharon would do it. Sharon's bright idea was to change the face of the Middle East politically, diplomatically. That Lebanon, which had been mired in a civil war for 7 years at that point, starting in 1975, had been a mixed religion state of Maronite or Eastern Orthodox Christian, and some Catholic Christians as well, and Islam, both Sunni and Shia. So it's a mix of a lot of different factions, but Islam and Christianity side by side. The rule was, ever since Lebanese independence in 1932, was that one religious group would have the presidency and one religious group would have the prime ministership. And that was a divided government, but you try to get along. And there was a time when that worked, and Lebanon was the Paris of the Middle East. But all falls apart in the late 70s. One of the reasons for it all falling apart is the presence of Palestinian refugees who are a bitter population for what happened to them in 1948 and don't like anyone, and no one likes them. And as we'll see, they get treated very poorly over the course of the war. So Sharon's bright idea is the Christian population is not necessarily pro-Israel, but has a common enemy in the Palestinians and in the Muslim world more generally. So let's try to find cooperative actors among the Maronites, the phalangists, and we'll help them win the civil war. We'll sign a peace treaty with Lebanon, and having done that, then Syria will find itself in an untenable situation, and they might collapse, and we'll hold on to the Golan Heights, and all will be well in the world, and there'll be peace on the northern border. So, how much Begin knew is to this day still a debatable point. I think that he knew almost nothing. That he just thought, Shalom LeGalil, we want peace in the Galilee, and Sharon is a former general and a war hero, he'll run the war, and whatever he says goes. But maybe I'm wrong. Yeah?
But strategically, isn't it very wrong to fight urban warfare?
So you that's what will happen, and the casualty rate will be, of course, tremendously higher. Okay, but if you remember, Sharon was not the first person to think of this idea. If you go to the video, to the audio tape of my lecture from October of 2018, this was, 3 months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, I said that David Ben-Gurion, in cooperation with Yigal Yadin, already in the early 1950s, actually in 1949, already thought about the possibility of Israel interfering in Lebanese affairs and installing a Maronite government that would make peace with Israel. It never came to pass. It was a sort of a pipe dream at the time. And in 1982, it's just as much of a pipe dream, except that they tried it, and hundreds of people died. Thousands of people died. Okay, so the war happens. June 6th, there's an invasion, and they go past the 25 miles, the 40 kilometers, they go all the way to Beirut. Once they get to Beirut, then the Americans get involved in trying to extricate the parties from the situation, have a PLO evacuation to North Africa, an Israeli withdrawal to further south to a security zone in the southern Lebanon. The Americans played an important role. Yeah?
Is it true that Sharon took him on his own accord to go up to Beirut versus the Knesset saying you can only go up to a certain amount and he decided to override?
He did no government decision, no cabinet decision or Knesset decision ever allowed an advance all the way to Beirut. It was the doing of the IDF under the orders of the chief of staff, Raful Eitan, and the defense minister, Menachem, Ariel Sharon. Huh? Yeah. People in positions of authority who control the guns can just take them and keep them moving. All right. Now, in September, you have the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, September 16th through the 18th, 1982. And this leads to a tremendous outcry the world over, not so much against the phalangists who committed the atrocity, but against Israel and the IDF for sitting idly by. And what was the government's reaction to the massacre? It's a very important question. The initial government reaction to the massacre was Begin's approach of Goyim kill Goyim and they blame the Jews. A very famous line. Goyim kill Goyim and they blame the Jews. He regarded any comparison to the Shoah or whatever as just anti-Semitic verbiage. That the world out there doesn't like the Jews and something bad may have happened, but they're taking advantage of this to stick it to their old foe, Am Yisrael. That was Begin's gut reaction. And there were others in the cabinet who agreed. But there's a massive outcry, a big gathering in Kikar Malchei Yisrael and Kings of Israel Square in Tel Aviv, 300,000 people, peace now, this is their moment in the sun. Now remember, peace now was established not in 1982. Peace now was established in 1978, as I said a few lectures ago. But this is their big moment after Sabra and Shatila. They want an end to the war, and they want the parties responsible for an atrocity to be held accountable. Well, does Begin respond to this outcry by giving in some fashion? The answer is actually no. Yes, there will be a commission of inquiry, the Kahan Commission, led by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But it wasn't in reaction to the big display of 300,000 people in the public square. No. It was because members of his own government were dissatisfied with what happened and wanted answers. Which people in the government? And this is very important. The National Religious Party ministers and the Sephardic ministers, including those from the Likud. So that the National Religious Party leadership in the cabinet wanted answers is an example of religious Zionism trying to be the moral conscience of the nation. That religious Zionism isn't just about a guy who wears a yarmulke and keeps kosher, but otherwise is an integrated Israeli. Rather, religious Zionism means that we have a conscience. We can't kill people. We can't commit atrocities. And the secularist may not have a neshama and a cheshbon nefesh, but we do. Yeah.
Well, we didn't.
Well, we'll see. Well, who's considered responsible? That's the national religious. What about the Sephardim? So I'm not so sure why this bothered the Sephardim more than the Ashkenazim. Maybe you could say that the fellow Middle Easterners were killed, okay? But, huh? I don't know. I'm not here to explain why the Sephardim were more sensitive, but I want to say one very important political point, and that is, it was long argued as a matter of ethnic stereotype and bigotry that Western Ashkenazic white Jews had a moral compass, and that the swarthy Middle Easterners, the dark-skinned Jews, were like all dark-skinned peoples, barbarians, and couldn't care less if there's an atrocity committed. Okay? That was the ongoing mythology and falsehood. And this belied that falsehood, that the Sephardic Jews were sensitive to an atrocity, and the white-skinned Ashkenazic government ministers tried to brush it under the rug. This is a very important moment in the moral history of Israeli politics. All right. Now, what happens next? The Kahan Commission is established, and they're collecting testimony. So the two leading figures in the government, Sharon and Begin, behave very differently. Begin is the constitutional Democrat. Begin believes in following the procedures and the protocols and is a stickler for formality. He had been ever since he was a lawyer in Poland in the 1930s. And so he testifies before the commission. State your name for the record. My name is Menachem Ben Zev. So he gives his formal name, and he gives his testimony to the best of his ability. Sharon doesn't want to testify and creates all sorts of bogeymen around to like against whom he has to defend Israel, that there are all sorts of enemies out there, and only I can defend Israel. Sharon was aware that his career could come to an abrupt end if this doesn't work out well for him. Now, the truth of the matter is, it doesn't work out well for him, but his career doesn't come to an end. Why? For complicated reasons. So, he also has a run-in with Time magazine, where Western media outlets disparage him and say that he's guilty of all sorts of sins, and he sues them for libel and wins. He wins. Okay. Well, the conclusion of the Kahan Commission, which came about in February of 1983, was that Raful Eitan should have to resign from his position as chief of staff, and Ariel Sharon bore indirect responsibility for the massacre at Sabra and Shatila and should be fired as defense minister. So Sharon is fired. Raful Eitan's term comes to an end. It is not extended. And as for Begin, in theory, he's not held accountable, and life goes on. Although we'll see that life for him takes a turn for the worse in a big way. Now, what happens to Sharon? So he was not fired from the government. He was removed from the defense ministry, but was given a lesser ministry. I forget which one. Nothing important. He had a responsibility for housing already in the late 70s. His portfolio was dramatically reduced in 83, but he was kept as a voting member of the cabinet because Begin's theory was it's better to have him in the government where he can't complain and deride us than to be on the outside when he can say have the worst invective. The worst invective.
Why did they condemn him if the New York Times examiner, you know, was
Well, the thinking was that Sharon should have been aware of, and maybe was aware of, the brutality as it was ongoing, and did not issue orders to stop it. There's a big debate as to how high up the chain of command knowledge of the atrocity went on the 17th of September. By the 18th of September in the morning, about 36 hours into what was going on, so then the IDF shut it down. But there may have been information trickling up much earlier that could have saved lives, and nothing was done. It's a debatable point. If you read Arab propaganda, they'll say as many as 3,500. If you read United Nations reports, I think it was something around 1,200 to 1,600. The IDF initial report was about 500. So there's a wide gap between IDF, international, and Arab news sources. So,
did the country fall into like a malaise after that?
No, I would not say there was a malaise afterwards. If there was any malaise, it was because of economic crises. Certainly not like after the Yom Kippur War. The malaise after the Yom Kippur War was real. After Lebanon, there were different attitudes towards military service, and
but there were women and children. I mean, this is all families.
Yeah. So people in Israel were very upset over the atrocity. So it was sincere remorse over what had happened. Now, what's the Labour Party's position on all of this? They're on the outskirts of Beirut.
And the phalangists killed the Arabs?
The phalangists came in and killed Palestinian refugees. Ostensibly, they went in to look for terrorists, to look for fighters who had not evacuated, because the PLO was supposed to have evacuated on ships in late August. The last bunch of them in early September, and then Jamal, the leader of the phalangists, was assassinated on September 14th, and so as a matter of revenge, they went in and did their business. Okay, so
were any of the participants brought to trial or brought to justice?
So they were brought to justice by assassination. The leader was assassinated in 2005, 23 years later. In 2005, in Lebanon, there were a lot of assassinations, if you remember. But a lot of the folks who were involved in the 82 atrocities got their comeuppance then. Yeah. Arafat went to Tunis. He left the last boat. He waved goodbye to Lebanon, and he went to North Africa. So, the Labour Party. What was the attitude of the Labour Party towards the Lebanese war? Well, as all good patriotic Israelis, Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, gave their support to the fight and did not criticize it right away. You don't criticize the government while they're conducting a war. But once the war extended beyond what the cabinet, what the Knesset thought was going to happen, they were getting jittery, they were getting antsy about this. This is not good. But still, hush, hush, don't say anything. It was not until after the massacre in the refugee camps that the Labour Party began, as a political institution, to criticize the government. And certainly this continued and was intensified after the Kahan Commission's report was released in February of 83. So now we have a machloket, a disagreement between the Likud and Labour over criticism of the war. Labour said that the Likud violated long-standing Israeli protocol of only fighting defensive wars, and that this was military adventurism of an unsafe and unwise variety, and therefore the government deserves all the censure you can give it. Whereas the Likud would say that the Labour Party violated long-standing Israeli policy of not criticizing a government that's at war. Okay? And that Israel was right to go to war against Lebanon, and even to go as far as Beirut, maybe, and the Labour Party should not have been in the business of criticizing military activities. And that while Likud themselves were in the opposition, they never did such a thing. They never ever criticized the government's conduct of war. Is that true? Yeah, it's basically true. Okay, but what about Israel never went to war for political purposes? Every war was a defensive war. So Menachem Begin argued that that's a lie. That in 1956, who went to war? David Ben-Gurion decided unilaterally to go to war together with England and France for reasons of changing the political dynamic in the Middle East and not because it was an essential war for Israel's security. Now, that's a read on the 1956 war. This is Ein Teretz, as they would say. But there are other reads of the 1956 war that say it was essential, it was absolutely necessary, and there was no other way around it. But the Likud, as a matter of talking points, was able to say, you're accusing us, you did the same thing 26 years earlier.
How far from the next election was this?
2 years. A long way.
Oh.
3 years. In theory, it's 3 years, but in fact, it was 2 years.
Were posturing already for
no,
the
posturing will begin late in 1983. So let's now get to, in the time we have left, what happens to Menachem Begin. Well, if you remember, during the 81 campaign, he had announced at first that he would retire halfway through the term. And then when he realized that he was the asset for the Likud campaign, not the rest of the slate, he said, no, I'll serve the whole term. It's going to be me the whole way through. You know, you trust me, go the whole way through. But, in fact, he ends up retiring on his 70th birthday, or 2 weeks after his 70th birthday in 1983. The last about 10 months of his term were a disaster. He could barely function. What was working against him? So, number one, his wife died. Aliza died while Menachem was in the air flying to give a speech in Los Angeles at the General Assembly of Jewish Federations. She had told him, go, you'll give your speech, you come back, I'll be okay, I'll be here when you get back. But she was horribly ill at the time, and she didn't make it. She died while he was in the air. The plane landed, he came back and went home. Okay, so that ruined him, because unlike David Ben-Gurion, who had multiple girlfriends, and Levi Eshkol, who had three wives, and Golda Meir, who had five boyfriends, okay, and Bibi Netanyahu had three wives, Menachem Begin had his one and only Aliza. Through thick and thin, they were together the whole way through. Okay, so it devastated him that he lost her, and that he was not there to see her when she was dying. Also, his health. He was basically an invalid at this point. He was in a wheelchair. He fell, he hurt his hip, he also had heart condition. So he's not doing well. Also, he's suffering from depression. Why? Because of the Lebanon War. Because the Lebanon War is not going well, and there's a high casualty count. And he cares for the lost lives of all the soldiers. He's not a ghoul who's insensitive to the loss of life. It hits him every time when a soldier died. Okay? Also, his policies in general are not doing well. His economic policy is failing, which we'll get to in a second. So, for all these reasons, it's time for him to walk away. And walk away he does on September 16th, 1983. Now, as for the economic issues, let's just spend about a couple of minutes on that. Is the Likud party a left or a right party when it comes to economics? It's a trick question. It's a trick question.
It's everything. It's the whole gamut.
Okay. Because the Likud party is not a party. The Likud party is a Likud. It's an amalgamation of several groupings, the two largest of which are Chirut and the Liberals. The Chirut party caters to whom? Low socioeconomic standing people who like a generous welfare state. So Chirut basically is populist, veering towards left of center economic policy. Not socialism in the sense of the government controlling distribution and production, but just generous social safety network. The Liberal Party represented the old general Zionists, who are what? Capitalists, business owners, who don't want to spend tax dollars on giveaways to the poor. So this was a long-standing machlokas in the Likud party between economic leftists and economic rightists. But who won the day? Well, which faction is stronger in the Likud, the Liberals or Chirut? Chirut! So the 1977 party platform was basically laissez-faire capitalism. By 1984, the election platform had major giveaways to the poor, social safety network. And the state of Israel can't afford this. Israel's going bankrupt. Why? Number one, project renewal, to clear out the urban slums and make them into pretty neighborhoods, which was in part funded by the state and in part funded by your generous charitable dollars in the late 70s, early 80s from UJA. Then, building settlements in the territories. They're expensive. You got to build roads, houses, water towers, electricity grid. Okay? The right wing wants settlement. They cost money. And can you have project renewal in Israel proper and settlements across the Green Line simultaneously? Well, you can try, but you can't afford it. It's one or the other, really. Also, the war is expensive. Defense expenditures. All right? Where is the money coming from? So public debt is soaring. Public and private consumption is soaring. The standard of living is going up. But it's all a bluff because they really can't afford it. The macroeconomic conditions are deteriorating. So it's fine that everybody has a color TV and we're building settlements, but eventually you got to pay for all these things. And if you can't even afford to pay the interest payments on Israel bonds, then the state goes mechula. Okay, so in the end, they pay the interest payments on Israel bonds. Israel bonds never defaults, but the government can't afford other things. And this crisis, inflation, hyperinflation. So that also is what put Menachem Begin really in his misery, that all the policies were not doing well.
That sounds something like Turkey.
Yeah, similar.
They did nothing but the construction, and they ended up with a debt that they can't handle.
They can't handle, yeah. Okay, so when Begin resigns, who's going to take over? Who are the candidates? Give me some names. Shamir, who else? Sharon, who else? Who else? Not on the labor side, on the Likud side only. So you have Shamir, Sharon, who else?
Levy.
Who else? He's too young, he's a little guy. Huh? Moshe Ahrens. And last, Yoram Aridor, the former finance minister. So, five candidates. Who's going to win? Well, it's all a matter of generation gap. Shamir's going to win. And the reason is, Begin was born in 1913. Shamir was born in 1915. So he's basically like the same guy. One is Irgun, one is Lechi. But the others are a half a generation younger. Aridor was born in the late 20s. Sharon was born in 1928. Ahrens was born in 1925. And Levy was born in 1937. So they don't want Levy to win. If Levy wins, he's going to be the Likud leader for the next 20 years. And they're all going to be dead by then. So they realize Levy has to be stopped if I ever want to be prime minister. So what's the best solution to the problem? Put in Shamir as the prime minister. He'll be an interim transitional figure. He's an oldster already. He's 68 years old. How long could he last? He'll finish out the term. He might lose to labor the next time around. And someone else, maybe me, that's what Aaron, Sharon, and Aridor think about who will lead the Likud party going forward. So they all throw their weight behind Shamir, and Levy is then encouraged, why don't you bow out? Why do we have to have a contested election? Why don't we just have, we'll crown Shamir as the next leader? Levy refuses to do that. He wants to run, and for the first time ever, the Likud party has a contested and open leadership campaign. Because up until that time, it was just a smoke-filled room of three guys, and Begin says, I'm the boss, and you have to accept it. So 800 people were voting, and the end result was Shamir defeated Levy 436 to 302. All right.
Who are these 800?
These are the Central Committee of the Likud Party. So he did very well for himself. Now, I want to talk about Levy for a minute. He didn't speak English, or at least not well. And he was born in Morocco, comes to Israel in the early 50s, makes Aliyah, he becomes the mayor of Beit She'an, he's an up-and-coming figure. And they put him at the number two position just to show that we put a Sephardic Jew at number two. But David Levy was the butt of all the jokes in Israel. Just like in America you have Polish jokes, so in Israel they had David Levy jokes. Now who does this guy think he is? He's a clown. He's going to be the prime minister of Israel. He was no clown. As it turned out, he actually was not a bad government minister for a long time, and he ran for the prime ministership and got pretty close. All right, he never made it all the way to the top, but he was no slouch. He didn't speak English, he couldn't communicate well outside of Hebrew, but for his constituency, he was considered a good guy. All right. Yes, yeah, because he was from Morocco, but he didn't speak English. And you got to speak English. That's the bottom line. So Levy loses. and Shamir wins, but very importantly, the ethnic component played no role. It was a gentleman's fight, and there were no ethnic slurs. This didn't get dirty, as opposed to in the 81 election, when it was very dirty on ethnic grounds between the left side and the right side of the aisle. Also, it was agreed in advance that the loser would accept the winner as the winner. Nobody was going to contest this as being rigged or being falsified. Everyone accepts the results. They announce that ahead of time. And the loser gets to become deputy prime minister. What's the relevance of being deputy prime minister?
Prime minister dies.
So if the prime minister were to die, maybe you have a leg up in becoming the successor, although it's not guaranteed. When he's out of the country, formally you're the prime minister for domestic affairs. And also, if the prime minister wants to give you a large portfolio of stuff to do, as a deputy prime minister, you have a nice fancy title and you could do a lot of things. Sometimes it's a big deal and sometimes it's a bluff. You know, later in the 1990s, it was a bluff. Netanyahu threw out that title just to make people happy. But at other times, he really did important work. Okay. But Shamir was an older fellow and a hardliner and didn't communicate well with the public. So it was not definite that he would lead the Likud party in the next election cycle, which was scheduled for 1985, but in fact what happened in 1984, we pushed forward. So Ariel Sharon runs against Yitzhak Shamir in 1984 for the leadership of the Likud, thinking to himself that I'm a heroic figure, a general, the people love me, Arik Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, and nobody really is in love with Shamir. He has his core of supporters, the old Lechi crowd, but no one's infatuated with him, no one loves him. But me, I'm Ariel Sharon, I could win. In the end, he loses. The vote total was 407 for Shamir, 306 for Ariel Sharon. What he had working against him was the war, that people were not happy with his handling of Lebanon, and that the Kahan Commission had shown that he was, you know, in disrepute. So there were enough people who thought that this is a liability. We don't want him at the top of the ticket. If we have him at the top of the ticket, we will lose to Labor. But what's happening in Labor? So Shimon Peres is in control of Labor. But the leadership of Likud did their best to portray Shimon as being unpatriotic, as being too quick to accept the Reagan administration's proposal for an Israeli withdrawal from Beirut and from Lebanon. That who is he, the leader of the opposition, to get involved in foreign affairs? There's only one prime minister and one foreign minister, and you, Shimon, as leader of the opposition, stay out of it. So Shimon had his averas as a leader of the opposition that the Likud was going to focus on in an election campaign. But Shimon wanted the election to be hastened and not wait till 85, because Rabin announced that he wants to challenge Shimon for the leadership of the Labor Party. And Shimon's always nervous, you know, Rabin is a war hero, I'm not, maybe he'll win. Granted, in 1980, Peres defeated Rabin, but now it's 1983, and maybe the electorate has a different approach towards things. So Peres wanted the election to be as soon as possible to prevent a hostile takeover by Rabin. The Knesset dissolves itself in January of 84, and schedules an election for the summer of 1984 to be a battle between Peres and Shamir. Now, in the few minutes we have left, I want to discuss the fate of the religious parties in the early 1980s. So, in the government, you had the National Religious Party, you had the Aguda, and you had Tami. Tami had a problem because Aaron Abuchatzero went to jail. He was charged another time with breach of trust and bribery and all sorts of financial crimes, and this time he actually was convicted. The first time he was exonerated. The second time he was convicted but didn't serve jail time. So he remained in the Knesset but had to resign from his position in the cabinet. That's actually even more offensive to me than what Aryeh Deri did. At least Aryeh Deri went to jail and came back later and ran for Knesset and joined the cabinet. But what about the Aguda? So the Aguda has an ethnic problem. What's the Aguda's ethnic problem? And don't tell me the Lithuanians versus the Yekis. So the Ethiopians is an issue, but not really a political issue. That's an issue of their Jewish status in 1984, and it gets resolved by Rabbi Ovadia, even though some of the Ashkenazim wanted to have a hard line and say they're not Jewish. But having mentioned Rabbi Ovadia, what's the ethnic problem in the Aguda? So the Sephardim are not being given sufficient representation, despite the fact that the Aguda voting population is heavily Sephardic. Okay, so Rabbi Ovadia, who's the outgoing chief rabbi, and by the way, wanted another term, and the Knesset voted against giving them another term. That Rav Goren and Rabbi Ovadia Yosef had a ten years together as the chief rabbis from 73 to 83, and they wanted an extension, and it was prohibited. So in the end, you had Rav Shapira and Rav Eliyahu became the chief rabbis. But Rabbi Ovadia, he encourages a breakaway. Let's run our own party in upcoming elections. So the forerunner to Shas runs as a Sephardic Aguda breakaway in the municipal elections in Jerusalem in 1983. And they do very well for themselves. And that little test run proved that you could have a Sephardic religious party do well on the national stage. And in the 84 election, that's Shas's first appearance running for the Knesset. Now, why might you have thought that a Sephardic religious party couldn't do all that well? Could not. So, from about 1951 until 1981, ethnic Jewish parties were not represented in the Knesset. The whole point of Zionism and the project that is the State of Israel as a Jewish state was to avoid ethnic differences, to homogenize everyone, and we're all Am Yisrael together. Now, that doesn't mean that people really felt that way. There's plenty of ill will. And the labor Likud divide, and the 81 election shows that there's a lot of ill will. But overtly ethnic parties run, especially the Yemenite group in the 50s, and they don't win. They don't get elected. People just are not going to throw their vote towards an ethnic party. Tommy in 81 was basically an ethnic Sephardic party, but it was really just a Sephardic version of the National Religious Party and the cult following of Abu Chatzera. So it's a flash in the pan, it doesn't repeat itself. Shas, if it's going to emerge, has to cultivate for itself a voting public that wants to vote for a religious party and wants to vote for an ethnic party that is one and the same. But is there really an audience for that? Maybe not. So what Shas will have to do to win over voters is to emphasize one over the other. And so they'll emphasize the Sephardic over the Orthodox in the hopes that non-Orthodox Sephardim will vote for Shas. So the whole history of Shas's electoral success between 1984 and 1999 is not in stealing black-hatted Jews, whether of Ashkenazic or Sephardic variety, but rather getting former Likud voters or former Tami voters or former National Religious Party voters to vote for basically a Moroccan party, because most of Shas were from Morocco, to a lesser extent from Iraq, Egypt. But it's going to be a gamble that no one knows how it will turn out. They will grow and grow and grow. From 84, 88, 92, 96, the party will increase until they finally get 17 seats in 1999. It's their high watermark. But in the beginning, it was very much an uncertainty. Now, what about the National Religious Party? So the National Religious Party is led by old Yosef Berg. But old Yosef Berg was seen in negative light by a lot of people, because they felt that he would do anything to keep his job in the cabinet. That he had been a member of the Knesset since 1949, a member of the government since the Stone Age, and that he wanted to keep his job as a government minister no matter what. And there's sort of a self-serving personality. That's not fair. I'm not presenting that as my criticism of him. I'm telling you that's what people thought in the 1980s. And they wanted him out. And they wanted somebody else in. The one who was much more well-liked by the public was Zvulun Hamer. Zvulun Hamer was the education minister and was considered the best education minister Israel ever had, and was seen as a moral conscience and a good guy all around. a beloved figure. So he is going to be the next wave after Berg can be put to the side. Okay, but what about in the Aguda? So in the Aguda, you have problems between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. And we're getting towards a phase in Israeli political history where the Aguda is not going to be able to sustain itself as a united party. The Poale Aguda, which was their offshoot, and more moderate religiously and more moderate on Zionism, has come and gone. But now you're going to have a machlokus between the Hasidim, who are going to be in the Aguda, and the Misnagdim, who are going to be in some kind of an offshoot. Now that offshoot later became known as Degel HaTorah. Officially, that party still exists, and they come together as United Torah Judaism, and that's been around basically since the 1990s. But already in the early 80s, you see there's a bit of a fissure because the Admorim, the Hasidish Rebbes, they throw around a lot of weight. But the Yeshivish crowd, like Rav Shach, they don't want to be kowtowing to the Lubavitcher Rebbe or the Ger Rebbe or the Belzer Rebbe. They want their own authority. And so we're going to see a breakdown in the Haredi vote. So we'll stop here, and next time we'll discuss 1984.